Next case is Barbara Pettiford versus Rajendra Agarwal.
Good morning, Chief Justice Brown, and may it please the Court. I am Kevin Popham of the Columbus law firm Arnold, Todaro & Welch, and I have the privilege here today to be representing the appellant and defendant below, Dr. Rajendra Agarwal. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. The critical question in this case and for the future of professional tort litigation in Ohio is, should a court disregard a non-party expert witness's affidavit submitted in opposition to summary judgment if that affidavit contradicts prior deposition testimony of that witness and there is no sufficient explanation for the contradiction?
Well, Mr. Popham, is there actually a contradiction, an unambiguous contradiction in this case?
Your Honor, yes, there is. When the expert testified that he had in the past reviewed the pertinent medical facts and the materials in the case and made a determination that he could not give an opinion on the causation issues in the case, we would argue that that in and of itself is an opinion. He formed an opinion that he had no opinion on causation. And then when he subsequently submitted the affidavit, there were clearly causation opinions contained within that affidavit.
Are you saying that the earlier testimony at deposition was that he could not form an opinion or simply that he had not considered the matter?
That he had not formed an opinion. He testified that he had reviewed the information, and I believe his words were to the effect, I pretty much determined at that point I couldn't give an opinion on the causation issues in this case, and therefore I haven't looked at it in a year and a half or 2.5 years.
Counsel, so why wouldn't that be a matter that goes to credibility? And because you have to way in favor of the non-moving party, why wouldn't it just be a credibility issue?
Your Honor, if there was an explanation in the affidavit for the contradiction, then I would agree that that's a matter that should go to the jury and should go to the weight and credibility of the witness. But in the occasion where the expert forms a totally contradictory opinion without sufficient justification, there's no rationale for treating that expert any differently than we treat the party witness who does the same thing. And in fact, there's rationale, I would argue, that supports the proposition that that expert witness should be treated the same as a party witness. For instance, the appellate court below, the Second District, focused on the fact that a party has counsel to protect that party against misstatements in the deposition and focused on the degree of control that's exerted over a witness. I would argue that this is not a case, and in cases involving expert witnesses, it's not about whether the independent third-party witness saw the traffic light to be red or green, and that's a misstatement of fact. In the context of professional tort litigation, where the issue is an expert witness's affidavit, that affidavit contains an opinion, not a statement of fact. And therefore, with that opinion, that goes to the heart of the matter in the case, the essential elements, you have to strictly scrutinize any change in opinion for several reasons. there is a great deal of control that's exerted over experts in these cases by the attorney. The attorney crafts the affidavit. In the world of medical malpractice litigation, our experts practice medicine. They don't practice law.
Was there a discovery schedule set up in this case?
There was, Your Honor.
And had discovery closed?
It had, Your Honor. At what point?
Well, you've concluded the deposition of this witness, had you not?
We had. That's correct.
And there was a motion filed for summary judgment.
There was a previous motion for summary judgment filed that was overruled, and then —
Well, what we have at issue is a motion for summary judgment that's pending before the court and a response with an affidavit attached, which is contradictory of the deposition testimony of that witness. Isn't that where we are in the state?
That's exactly where we are.
Why should we let one witness contradict his earlier opinion in order to create an issue of fact at that stage? Why can't a party rely on the testimony that was given and at the close of discovery?
That's exactly our point. We shouldn't allow that to happen. The motion for summary judgment that was filed at the end of the case was a renewed motion at the direction of the trial judge.
Is there any case authority that permits a party to contradict an earlier given deposition testimony?
There is case authority that says that, and I think this court's Byrd decision would say that, even though there may be a contradiction, if there's a sufficient explanation within the affidavit that explains that contradiction, then the trial judge can allow that to go to the jury and it goes to the weight or the credibility of the witness. But in a case such as this, where there was absolutely no explanation and the facts would show that there was absolutely no additional evidence, no facts, no testimony, nothing that came to light between the period of the time of the deposition and the authoring of the affidavit, then there is no sufficient justification for the contradiction.
So the affiant here then is limited to the deposition, is stuck with his deposition testimony, as so too is the plaintiff, unless there's notice given to the other side that there's been a development, there's been an epiphany, there's been some kind of information that came to light that would change, and then obviously there would have to be an opportunity to redepose even prior to a summary judgment. Would you not agree?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and I would say that epiphany, that notice could come in the form of explanation through the affidavit, at which point the opposite side should be given the opportunity to pose that witness, redepose, so that there's no surprises going into the courtroom. Because
when would you say the subsequent deposing would take place? Prior to the affidavit being submitted for the contrary to the summary judgment?
Well, I believe it would be. I mean, without the affidavit, there's no notice of the changed opinion.
Exactly. So, I guess I'm saying that the affidavit, even with a explanation contained in it, would still be, it would create the necessary controversy over what the facts were and defeat the summary judgment. Then the normal course would be to then redepose that doctor based on the contents of that affidavit.
If the moving party would so request, I think that in the interest of fairness and justice in the pretrial period would require discovery on those changed or new opinions contained in the affidavit, yes. Okay.
And if there were no summary judgment and we got into trial, would we permit this witness to change his opinion or offer a new opinion different from the deposition testimony at trial? Do you have any or intend to render an opinion on causation in this case? Answer, no. And then suddenly at trial, he expresses an opinion that the Ms. Pettiford suffered the crisis of a collapsed lung as a direct and proximate result of Dr. Agarwal. So would that be acceptable practice? Is that what we're trying to encourage?
I think that if you limit the analysis to that line of questioning in the deposition, where you simply ask the witness, do you intend to render the opinion? No, I do not intend to render an opinion. And then subsequently they render an opinion. That goes to the weight or the credibility of that opinion and of the witness. But in this case, moving on in the deposition, it's when the deponent testifies specifically, I made a determination that I couldn't give a causation opinion in this case. That's the key
testimony. So I haven't looked at that issue for a year and a half, and so
exactly
his you're relying on the fact of his response to the fact that he couldn't testify or give an opinion about causation at the time of the deposition.
That's absolutely correct, and that in and of itself is an opinion that he formed, and
but
thereafter.
There seems to be some splitting of hairs here, though, because the plaintiff says, well, my doctor said I couldn't testify that she would or would not have lost the lung. But now in his affidavit he's saying, but I can testify that if it had been diagnosed, you wouldn't have had the collapse in the emergency room. It would have been dealt with in a more normal course of action with less pain and trauma. There seems to be a distinction, and shouldn't that be a jury issue? Shouldn't that go to the jury?
If... And that's obviously their argument, that I didn't ask the right questions in the deposition, and had I asked him a specific question that would have elicited that answer, he would have given me the answer. But if you move to the end of the deposition, being a non-physician, I can't possibly get inside that expert physician's mind and ask every possible question about every medical issue in the case. If you go to the end and I ask the expert, have we covered all of the opinions that you formed in this case? And he answered in the affirmative. You combine that question with the I couldn't give any opinions on causation. You combine those two, I think you have.
Yeah, but you're sort of boxing a medical expert into a legal box, and they may not get exactly what you're after, what you're trying to say, and they may well have a different opinion, but it's not covered by the way you're asking the questions because they don't understand your mind either.
In this particular case, the expert was a very experienced expert. In his deposition, he testified as to his experience. He understood the issues of standard of care and causation.
But if we write law for all cases, maybe we have the next doctor that isn't an expert.
That's true, and I think that this determination largely is a case-by-case basis based upon the information that's contained in the affidavit, whether there's sufficient justification, based upon the questions that are listed in the deposition. But clearly, where you have an expert witness that's under a great deal of degree and control by an attorney, is paid by both sides for that testimony, I think that public policy and in order to maintain the integrity of the judicial process and the utility of summary judgment as a mechanism for terminating litigation in the pretrial period when it is appropriate.
Counsel, let me back this up just a little bit. In reading what you've got in the front of your brief, I find more problematic in the early stages the doctor's statement that, no, I don't intend to render any opinions about the treatment that might have taken place had the diagnosis occurred earlier. And no, I don't intend to render any opinions about the effect of the alleged 3-year delay. I assume your doc didn't get sued because she got lung cancer. He got sued because he didn't catch it. Isn't that right?
That's true, Your Honor.
So when you get down to the question of, I pretty much determined I couldn't testify, couldn't testify or give an opinion about causation, wouldn't that possibly or reasonably be understood to refer to the cause for the cancer in the first place? And one would expect he wouldn't be able to nail down why she got lung cancer. But backing up to the earlier part, it would seem the plaintiff doesn't have a witness and maybe should have gotten out on summary on that basis.
If you look at the procedural history of the case, when the motion for summary judgment was first filed, actually the second time in the case, but the first time in the refiled action, it was filed on the issue of standard of care and causation. The affidavit from this very same physician that was submitted in response to summary judgment only dealt with standard of care issues, and the trial court actually overruled the summary judgment and didn't address causation at all. So I would agree with that. I don't believe that the plaintiff in this case had any causation testimony in the case, and therefore the case should have been terminated long before, a week before trial.
Counsel, it seems like it's the real issue in many of these cases is there a contradiction? Because you have the deposition that's to try and nail down exactly what the parties are going to say when they're called, and you can supposedly rely on what is stated on deposition. Then later on, if there's an affidavit filed, the first thing you see is there a contradictory affidavit? And if the affidavit is contradictory, what you would have us write is that there must be an explanation as to why there is now a contradiction, correct?
That's absolutely correct, and that's this court's analysis in the Byrd case.
In Byrd case. And the appellate court apparently said, well, Byrd only related to parties, not to expert witnesses. My question is, would you have us apply Byrd for any witness, not just the expert witness?
I would I'm only here today to argue on behalf of the expert witness, because I think that the reasoning in Byrd that holds that decision doesn't apply to the, as I mentioned before, the independent witness is standing on the corner and is going to come into court and testify, was a traffic light red or green, a witness over which neither side has any control. I don't think that the same reasoning applies. But I do believe that given the nature of the degree and control that a party exerts over their own expert, that brings that expert within the gambit of Byrd and subjects that expert to the same scrutiny as we would put on a party.
Mr. Popham, similarly, would you have that rule apply to expert witnesses in all cases or only in medical negligence cases? And if you want to limit it to the proposition of law, medical negligence, how do you do that?
No, Your Honor. I would say that an expert witness is an expert witness if that witness is going to render opinion testimony, whether it's an architectural expert, an engineering expert, a medical expert, a legal malpractice expert. I think the same analysis would hold true across the board.
Do we need to write anything more than we've already written in Byrd?
Your Honor, I think we do. I think that there's a confusion, at least between the 8th District and the 2nd District, as to whether Byrd applies to non-parties. I believe that the question certified to this court in Byrd was more general than the holding that came out of that decision. I think the question certified was applied generally to all witnesses, whereas the court held that it applied only to parties. And I think,
but realizing that we're not going to write a rule for the resolution of Pettiford versus Agarwal, but for every similarly situated case, what is the statement, what is the rule that you want this case to stand for?
That the rationale of Byrd, that a contradictory affidavit that's submitted by an expert witness in opposition to summary judgment without sufficient explanation for the contradiction within that affidavit should be disregarded by the trial court, should not be allowed to create a genuine issue of material fact.
You want us to adopt a sham affidavit rule in Ohio out of this case. Is that it?
I believe that.
You think that affidavit is a sham?
I do, Your Honor, and I believe that, in essence, Byrd is an
adoption of a sham affidavit. Well, are we going to go that far? Is that what you're asking us to adopt, a sham affidavit rule in Ohio or not?
Yes, I do, as applied to parties, which I believe is, in essence, the Byrd decision, and right, as applied to expert witnesses, which would be from this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Powell.
Thank you.
Mr. White.
Mr. White, is your argument mostly that there was no contradiction here? Or is it that the Byrd rule should not apply to expert witnesses?
Your Honor, my argument today is that, first of all, there definitely was no sham affidavit that was created in this case, and I can get to the specific facts of that case. But overall, I don't believe that the holding of Byrd should be applied universally to all witnesses, which is in effect really the way that the question that was certified to the court was whether or not Byrd should be, in its analysis and application, should not only apply to parties, but it should apply to witnesses. That's the question that was certified to this court.
Although counsel did limit it, when I asked, he was limiting it solely to expert witnesses. Would you also disagree with that?
Actually, he's proposed a hybrid that actually he's now saying expert witnesses. Now he is a medical malpractice insurance defense lawyer, and that's what he is. And he's asking this court for a bifurcated holding of Byrd that applies to all of the clients that he represents.
Well, he said all expert witnesses, including like architects and so on. So that's beyond just the medical malpractice.
And I think that as a public policy issue, just even bifurcating it to expert witnesses, I would actually look now actually to the facts of this case as to why that would actually create a public policy problem all the way around, because you've got for example, in this case, and you go right to the issue of the very questions that are the nature of what's going on in this case. First of all, you have an expert. Experts, by their very nature, are not attorneys. Do not have the same control over experts, which has been suggested here. That there's a lot of control over experts. Attorneys have a great deal of control over their parties. Have a great deal of access to their parties. Really, have unlimited access to their parties to control, manage, do even mock depositions ahead of time. Even tape the depositions ahead of time and see how they work and how they. And how to even prepare for the questions at a time. To suggest even closely that you have that kind of a relationship with expert witnesses who are usually even, especially doctors, neurosurgeons especially, and oncologists very specific, they're paid by the minute to be there. The first 15 minutes are
expert. That doesn't preclude you getting accurate information, does it?
No, it doesn't preclude getting accurate information. What it does do is it does not put parties and expert witnesses in a similarly situated position, which has been suggested by the appellant, and nor does it suggest in any way that the attorney for a plaintiff has that type of a control over the witness, an expert witness at all.
Aren't you pretty much hanging your hat on what the expert witness says? I mean, it doesn't matter what your client said her diagnosis was or the causation was or how she feels about it or anything related to that. You're hanging your hat on what the expert witness will establish for you when it comes to promoting your cause of action, correct?
In this particular case, what I was hanging my hat on and what actually something that's been lost in all of this are the two cases that have primarily been cited by the plaintiff or by the appellant in this case with regard to medical malpractice issues and expert testimony with regard to causation. Both of those cases, the Presidente case and the Roberts v. Presidente and the Charity Sisters of Charity case, both are loss of chance of survival cases. They are not medical malpractice cases that are this case. Those were loss of chance of survival in death cases where you had a doctor, where you had people trying to predict the probability of whether they would have lived or not had the medical malpractice issue been.
Whatever the subject matter is of the case, loss of survival chance, or in this case, not a death, but the loss of the lung and whether that would have occurred with earlier diagnosis. You're still relying on your expert witness.
Yes, we're relying on the expert witness, especially in. But this case, he had actually met the primary criteria for which the issue which was in dispute. Dr. Agarwal flat out in his deposition, which is not part of the record, but flat out asserted and does assert, even still today, no tumor on the June of 1999 x-ray. If there was a tumor, it was so obscure and it was so unable to be discerned that I shouldn't be held accountable for lacking the discernment of it. We have, and he was a family doctor who took his own x-ray.
Read the own x-ray. I understand all that. But
right.
But you needed an expert witness. You brought in an expert witness to say that that they didn't agree with the defendant's assessment of how he handled the case. This is the standard of care.
Yes. And actually, if you look at what...
Okay,
what
all right. Let me finish. You've got the standard of care. And then the next question is the causation. And your expert did not testify as to the causation.
Actually, if you look at exactly the way the question reads, which is in the transcript, both the transcript of Dr. Sickles, and I'll give you the different page numbers between the transcript of Dr. Sickles versus the transcript of the appellant in their supplemental merit brief of appellant, which was filed January 27, 2010, which does have a complete recitation of the transcript of Dr. Sickles, but those page numbers at the bottom are supplement, and those page numbers are slightly different than the ones that are at the top. So I'll reference them, and you say the exchange, which is set forth in the motion as well, beginning on deposition, page 38, line 22, and supplement to the Supreme Court merit brief, supplement, page 43, the question by counsel Popham to Dr. Sickles was, do you intend to render any opinions concerning the treatment that she may or may not have undergone had a diagnosis been made in 99? If you actually look back one page, he is asked, whether or not he's asked, first of all, that actually, and the reason it's going to be confusing a little bit, but I'll have you point to both the areas. Counsel, and this is why testimony with expert witnesses is inherently different from parties as well. You actually have the same line of questioning occurring 22 pages apart in the deposition. And what you've got here is a cutting and pasting of portions of transcript from page 38 of the original transcript, and then you have a cut and paste with the second half of what you're seeing, and which looks like a chronology.
All right, let's get away
56.
From the testimony in your case. Let's just
sure.
All right, go with a hypothetical, and you've got an expert witness that cannot establish causation. Just let me finish
sure.
here. And when asked, all right, and everybody leaves the deposition, and it's clear that this is not the expert for the causation. And then, lo and behold, 3-6 months later, there is a motion for summary judgment. There's no notice to the defendant that, hey, by the way, I've got an expert now that will establish causation, and that happens to be the person who was already deposed. So the summary judgment is filed. The plaintiff responds with the affidavit trying to establish the fact that there are material issues to be decided and summary judgment is inappropriate. Given that set of circumstances, as I just outlined them, forget about your case. What would you think that the result should be, which is, you know, the application of Byrd to the expert witness or not?
The difference between what the question would be is whether it is truly a contradiction. Did you change or alter?
Say it is. Let's give me.
It's a changing or an altering, and I would actually take in a continuum. You've got five words that I would use, and the change and alter are the most severe, and they're to the left. And if you do change or alter substantive facts, then that's an issue that I think goes much stronger to the weight of credibility that would be given to that witness's new affidavit. But if you've got an amendment an explanation, a clarification, or actually not it's supplementation, which is primarily the Byrd question and primarily the federal district court question, is it a supplementation? The issue would be whether or not the original opinion was genuinely changed or altered, or was the a subsequent affidavit a modification or a supplementation of the original opinion. If the first opinion only went on a scale of 1 to 10 up to 5, but now you've got 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, that's an amendment.
Let's back up here. Absent explanation for the change in testimony from the deposition to the affidavit, nothing on the record, nothing contained in the affidavit of why I said A 6 months ago and now I say B, which is what is alleged to have happened here, and that's what we're asked to hold an opinion on. What's your position on that?
My position on that would be that if it is truly just in a vacuum, which is actually still not the case here, but in a vacuum, if you have got a subsequent affidavit, I would still go to whether or not it is fundamentally a change or an altering of the original opinion, changing the nature of it, or if it's an amendment or supplementation. If there's no explanation for it, and it is a witness, the problem gets...
It's an expert witness.
It's an expert witness. I believe that in that case...
Should the affidavit be considered by the court or thrown out?
I believe that the court... You asked earlier to appellant whether or not there should be another deposition. I believe the court, in order to verify whether or not this is an amendment or a supplementation, there should have been a hearing on the issue of the affidavit. And there should be a hearing by the court. You had asked earlier whether
it be... Was there a hearing in your case? Did you prevail because there was a hearing on the affidavit?
No, I believe the court should have a hearing to verify whether or not what the nature of what this was, and an explanation for that, an explanation of that affidavit without guessing in a vacuum.
Counsel, would you give me an explanation of why you think this was not a contradiction?
Very, very definitely. If you look back to page 38 of the transcript, which is page 43 of the supplemental merit brief, question 22, do you intend to render any opinions concerning the treatment that she may or may not have undergone and had a diagnosis been made in June of 99? Here he clearly said, actually it's the second line of questioning 22 pages later. Continuing at deposition page 56, what is your understanding of Ms. Pettiford's subsequent diagnosis in 2002? Again, this is part of the issue of you've got the whole line of questioning being done again 22 pages later. What was she diagnosed with? My general recollection is lung cancer, but I can't even recall the specific facts because after I looked at the records, I pretty much determined I couldn't testify or give opinions about causation. This was not lung cancer. This was a non-carcinoid tumor. He didn't even have it right. He didn't remember it because it was a year and a half later. That's how much control attorneys possibly have over expert witnesses.
Well, with an admission like that, I guess I'd question whether you'd pay his fee. But that's a question for a different issue.
But the issue would be, that's why this is so important, the fact he states flat out here, he assumed it to be lung cancer because he's remembering. He says, before this, I didn't even look at these records in a year and a half.
You're stuck with the witness you had.
Yes.
Okay, so let's go back to not really being concerned with Ms. Pettiford versus the doctor. Let's talk about, a rule of law that's going to be for all parties similarly situated here. And that is, what do we do with expert witnesses who change their testimony under these type of circumstances? They go from position A to position B, deposition to affidavit. Affidavit is submitted to thwart a summary judgment. It's as simple as that. Does the court say invalid affidavit, summary judgment prevails?
No. because the court needs to have at least a minimum of an understanding of what the nature of the reason for the change is.
I think there's no explanation for change. There is no explanation for change before the affidavit is submitted. Now, you're saying, based on your answer previously, that then the court has to have a hearing to determine the underlying cause for the change in deposition to affidavit. That's not the court's responsibility to do that.
No, I think that that's where we have to go. I think, actually, it's still pigeonholing the nature of the change, and you'd have to go to the fact-by-fact case of what was the original opinion. If the original opinion was, I could never say whether or not it was a tumor 3 years ago. But now today, all of a sudden, he can say it was a tumor. That is a change. That's a change of an objective, verifiable fact. Here, he was asked an opinion about something with a presumed, where he presumes, and he states that he presumed a condition that didn't actually even exist. And then he says he's taking that, and actually we're being asked by appellant's counsel, said this was a super expert. This was a really skilled expert, so we got to assume he really knew what I was asking.
But Mr. White, isn't it just that it's the sufficiency of the affidavit when you have a summary judgment motion? Would it be that difficult? What we're talking here is if you have an expert who said something on deposition, there's a summary judgment motion that's filed. You wish to defend against the motion and have an affidavit filed by your expert. Isn't it just a matter of being sufficient? If there's going to be some type of supplement or explanation, that it be put in the affidavit itself.
I agree. And if you look at the affidavit, he clearly says here, and I just want to point out one thing about the problematic factor of why this case should not be whatever. This has an excellent example for how to make holdings, but not for the facts of the issue. This January 30th, 2008, final pretrial occurred in chambers at 4 in the afternoon. This motion was filed at about 9:58 in the morning. The judge, and at that point in time, which is a new judge, the third judge, she had just been appointed by the governor, and Judge McCracken had been the interim visiting judge who was going to take the case but didn't, and then it was transferred to Judge McGee once she replaced Jack Davis.
Counsel, was your argument, since I see your time has expired, is your argument essentially that whatever, you don't want the rule that's being proposed, but if it were applied, it wouldn't affect the outcome in your case in any event? Is that the summary of what you're telling us?
The rule is a bad rule if it's applied to witnesses, because the level
I understand you've made that point, but your further point is, and even if we would adopt that rule, it doesn't affect the outcome in your case. Is that your argument? Or it does affect the outcome in your case, so we'd have to reverse.
The Second District Court of Appeals felt that the Byrd analysis should not be superimposed upon a witness. So I would not, and not because it's just my case, because it's a poor law all the way around, if you actually superimpose the duty of the same level of control onto.
Counsel, I understand that argument. You've made it several times. But what I'm trying to get at is, if we should adopt the rule contrary to the Second District, I think I understand your argument is that it wouldn't impact your case, this case, because the affidavit wasn't contradictory. Is that your argument?
That's absolutely true anyhow.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. White.
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. Thank you.
The court will take a short break. I'm sorry. Mr. Popham, had you reserved some time?
I did.
All right. You may have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Chief Justice Brown. I'd like to just make sure the record is clear. The proposition of law that we proposed in this case was that in a medical negligence action, an affidavit of a non-party expert witness. We did not appeal this case and ask for this court to apply this rule to all witnesses, as was indicated. expert witness submitted in opposition to summary judgment that contradicts or is inconsistent with former deposition testimony of that witness may not, without sufficient justification or explanation, create a genuine issue of material facts sufficient to defeat the pending motion for summary judgment.
Counsel, where would you envision that explanation be if there was one? Why deposition testimony A and affidavit testimony B are now being utilized? At what point is it contained in the affidavit, or is it, as opposing counsel would suggest, incumbent upon the trial court when they see this objection raised to the summary judgment opposition by the moving party, say, well, hold everything, let's have a hearing to determine why the affidavit is contradictory?
Your Honor, it would have to be in the affidavit because under Civil Rule 56C, there's only a certain amount of evidence that a trial judge may consider when considering summary judgment. And I don't think it's incumbent upon the trial court to continue to make further inquiry.
So there has to be, but in this situation, opposing counsel is saying, well, I didn't do that because there's no contradiction here. That the right questions weren't asked originally, and there is a consistency in the contents of the affidavit.
I would respectfully disagree with counsel's position. I believe that there is a contradiction, and I think that whether or not a contradiction exists is a determination that the trial judge has to make in determining whether or not to consider the affidavit. In this particular case, I asked the expert, do you intend to render any opinions as to the effect of the alleged 3-year delay upon the patient's treatment or course? The affidavit, which, by the way, does not, it contains alleged facts, but it's really an affidavit of opinion, reads, I believe that Ms. Pettiford endured pain and suffering for an extensive period of time as a direct and proximate result of Dr. Agarwal's negligence in failing to diagnose the tumor in her right lung. So that's an opinion about her course. I further believe that Ms. Pettiford suffered the crisis of a collapsed lung and extended hospital stay as a direct and proximate result of the negligence of Dr. Agarwal. Again, an opinion on causation related to her course, of which I had previously asked him, and he indicated he had no opinion.